Good morning. Welcome to everyone, and a very special welcome to those who might be joining us for the first time or after a while away. It's so good to be with you, especially this Sunday, and to have you as part of this community. We come into this time and this sacred space, recreating it each week. And this week we do so after a week that was difficult for many, in the aftermath of an election that really shocked most of us, indeed all of us, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Libertarians, and Greens, really didn't expect this result of the election. And in our nation as a whole, about half of the people are joyful with the results, and about half of the people are deeply depressed and angry and fearful. The divides in our nation are deep, and the distrust is high. And it's no surprise, I don't think, that it comes after a most troubling political campaign season, one that I can never remember anything like before. And it's one in which the things we value most, the things that we say we affirm as Unitarian Universalists, our principles, were directly attacked and even mocked. Women, blacks, Latinos, gay, lesbian, transgender folks, the disabled, in the course of this election were insulted and degraded. Truth and honesty and high moral character just seemed unimportant. Notions of justice and fairness and compassion were set aside. Environmental degradation seemed to be okay. The election, I think, brought out and even legitimized some very deeply held prejudices and probably the worst in our human behavior. Many Latinos and blacks feel that their country has really let them down right now. Many women fear losing their right to control their own bodies. Many same-sex couples believe that their marriages are in jeopardy. This week I have talked with many who felt the results of this election on a truly personal level because of who they are. And these were very powerful and, in fact, very difficult conversations with a lot of raw pain and anger and depression. The result of this election resonates in many of us at a very deep and personal level, and in ways I think other elections in the past probably have not. And yes, there are many people who do feel good about this election. They feel safer and more secure. They feel that better jobs and cheaper health care are on the way. Each side has real disdain for the other. And I think what we have learned above all else in this election is that we are a deeply divided country. And it seems hard to even think about how we could move forward as one nation. And so what do we do? Well, if our candidate lost, we need to share our fears and concerns and both give support to others and be supportive of them too. If our candidate won, we need to try and understand the fears and concerns of those on the other side. And today, after the service, in the parlor will be an opportunity for those who wish to do that this morning, a safe space which will be facilitated. But we need to do more than that. We also need to reaffirm our values and keep them forefront to the center in every way that we can, in all the public debates that we can. We need to be sure that those things we value are not mocked or ignored, but are part of the political process, that they are a guiding light, and that our leaders are held to those high standards. The election is over, and the results are what they are. And those people who voted for one candidate and those who voted for the other both have a choice to make. Will this just be a nasty, ugly time with more and more hate and division? Or, still holding on to our values, Will we try to reach out to each other? Will we try to build bridges rather than dig the chasm of division even deeper? It won't be easy, but I believe we are called to do both, hold to our values and to build bridges. As Mike lights our chalice, let us reflect upon those bridges that we might build. Let us reflect upon the light that burns in us and carries our values to the world will shine brightly in the time ahead. Please be seated and welcome Eileen back, our intern from last year. And be attentive to her message for all ages.
Thank you. Well, as many of you who know me know, I love to give messages for all ages, and today I have a special one. It was written by a good friend of mine who, like Michelle, is a director of religious education, and her name is Alexis. So she used to be a nanny, and she was a nanny for a family with a little girl named Brenda. So this story is about Brenda and her family. And this story today is in honor of Veterans Day, which was on Friday. So this story is called Where's Daddy? By Alexis Capon. Think about a typical weeknight. People come home from work or school or play. Somebody starts to cook dinner. Then maybe it's time for homework or to take a bath and then to start getting ready for bed. Or maybe your usual weeknight is a little different, but no matter how it happens, there's usually a rhythm to it. If there are two parents in a family, each takes a set of responsibilities. And though they may be different, most of the things that happen are the same. Of course, some nights are different. Maybe one parent had a really bad day and asks the other to step in more. Or maybe you had a bad day at school, and instead of getting to watch TV, you get sent to bed. It's not always the same, but the pieces fit together. Well, Brenda's life was like this. She was a little girl, just 8 months old, but every day had a rhythm. She would get up, she ate breakfast, she spent the day playing and napping, and then mommy or daddy would put her to bed at night. But when she was 9 months old, it all changed. One day she got a big, soft blanket to play on, covered in pictures of daddy. But daddy wasn't around anymore. She also got a stuffed monkey, and every night her mom would push the button in the monkey's arm, and the monkey would say, "Good night, Brenda, sleep tight, sweet dreams, daddy loves you." Sometimes Brenda would push the button over and over before falling asleep. Months passed, and everyone kept talking about daddy and pointing to his picture on the blanket or on the wall. Occasionally, Brenda could talk to him on the computer through Skype, but sometimes weeks would go by without a word. When Brenda was 18 months old, mommy took her onto the military base, to the landing area. A big airplane was there, and lots of people were getting off the plane. One of the men walked up to Brenda and mommy and gave them both a big hug. Mommy laughed and cried and seemed very, very happy. But Brenda was a little scared of this strange man, but since mommy was happy and mommy was holding her, she smiled and laughed too. The strange man came home with them, and when they got there, mommy asked Brenda, "Where's daddy?" She didn't understand why the man looked sad when Brenda grinned and ran across the room and pointed to the picture on the wall. Mommy explained to Brenda that yes, that is a picture of daddy, but look, here's the real daddy. He's come home from Afghanistan. Brenda looked at the picture and then at the man. The man looked different. His face was tanned, and he looked skinnier and harder than daddy. Mommy explained again that daddy had been deployed. He had to go away for a while for work, but he was home now. Well, that night, daddy went to put Brenda to bed, and she got really upset because he didn't let her pick out stories before getting into pajamas. And he sat in the rocking chair funny, and he didn't say his prayers the same way that mommy did. You see, while daddy had been gone, the rhythm had changed. Daddy didn't know what the new rhythm was, And Brenda didn't remember what it had been like when Daddy had been there. He had been gone for half her life. The next day, Daddy started to make Brenda breakfast and discovered that some new dishes had been purchased while he had been gone, which meant that other dishes had had to move. Well, he got really frustrated when he couldn't find the dish he was looking for. Over the next few weeks, there were a lot of times when Mommy or Daddy or Brenda would get frustrated. You see, they had all changed while Daddy was gone, and they didn't know how to live together again. Daddy was also very different from before. Mommy and Brenda learned quickly to never wake Daddy up by touching him, but instead to shout from across the room. They also learned to walk with a little stamp in their step, because if they walked too quietly, Daddy would get startled. Daddy had to learn things, too. He learned how Brenda liked to pick the book to read for bedtime, that she didn't like going down the twisty slide at the park, that she liked to have her feet tickled until she got the hiccups. Brenda learned how bedtime felt when Daddy was doing it instead of Mommy, and she learned that Daddy could carry her on her shoulders and she could reach the ceiling or toss her in the air and catch her again. And Mommy and Daddy learned how to share space and to share their lives again. But then Daddy got deployed again. It was different this time. Brenda was older now, and she understood what being deployed meant. She didn't get confused and think that Daddy was a picture on the wall. But she still wondered, where's Daddy? And sometimes she would get so angry. She didn't want Daddy to be gone. She didn't want Mommy to be sad. She wanted her whole family to be together. But the next time Daddy came back, Brenda raced into his arms. There was still a period of time when everyone had to adjust. After a while, Daddy had been gone, and he had changed. Brenda had also grown and changed. It still wasn't easy, but this time, Mommy and Brenda helped to make it easier. Brenda helped Mommy put notes on the cabinets when they moved things, like the dishes, and Mommy helped Brenda make a picture book for Daddy about how bedtime went now, so he would know how to do it when he came home. Mommy, Brenda, and Daddy were more understanding and gave each other time to figure out the new rhythm. And I do believe that now Brenda is a big girl of 7 or 8 years old. So many thanks for listening to my story, and many thanks to my colleague Alexis for sharing this story about a little girl that she knew and loved a lot.
There's so much this week that we're going to go into our time of meditation with a sung prayer, I think I would call it that. And I hope those words speak to you.
So many things we can't control, so many hurts that happen every day, so many heartaches that pierce the soul, so much pain that won't ever go away. How do we make it better? How do we make it through? What can we do when there's nothing we can do? We can be kind. We can take care of each other. We can remember that deep down inside we all need the same thing. And maybe we'll find, if we are there for each other, that together we'll weather whatever tomorrow may bring. And it's not enough to talk about it, not enough to sing a song. We must walk the walk about it, you and I. Do or die, we've got to try to get along. We can be kind, we can. can take care of each other. We can remember that deep down inside we all need the same thing. And maybe we'll find, if we are there for each other, that together we'll weather whatever tomorrow may bring. And maybe we'll find true peace of mind if we always remember we can be
calm. You've been coming here for a while, you know that each month we select a particular nonprofit organization that this church is connected with, a mission that this church works on to share our collection with. And this month it is the Southeast India Project, and Bob Tabor is going to speak to us about that.
Thank you, Tom. And hello, everyone. I need that. Thank you. It was almost 12 years ago, on December 26, 2004, that a powerful earthquake in the Indian Ocean sent a wave hurtling towards Indonesia, India, Thailand, Sri Lanka. When the wave reached these countries, traveling at 600 miles an hour, it struck land as a tsunami, swallowing entire villages, killing over 200,000 people. I responded by contacting all the relief agencies, and within 2 weeks I was in India. At first I lived in an orphanage for Dalits, the term for the caste formerly known as untouchables, with 40 children and 3 adults. I also spent my days in the tsunami-affected villages where 15,000 people died. I was in primitive villages where a third to half of the people were suddenly gone, swept out to sea by the tsunami. I spent 3 months with the survivors, witnessing acts of courage and perseverance, love and support, and I helped to feed, clothe, and rebuild villages and lives. When I returned to America, this church, this community, asked how you could help the children at the orphanage and in the devastated villages. Each January, I returned for 4 to 6 weeks, and with support from this community, we're making a difference in the lives of children at the orphanage and in the fishing villages. The first year, 4 families at FPC offered to sponsor children at the orphanage, providing a child with a safe, healthy place to live, as well as food, clothing, medical care, and an education. It costs $400 per year to bring a child into the orphanage and transform their lives, and we're now sponsoring 16 children. Vicky's accompanied me for 4 years, Joe Holmes twice. There are now 67 children at the orphanage, each sponsored by a family from this community or individuals in Holland, 56 girls, 11 boys. During these 12 years, we've helped children complete 10th standard in school. Many continue on a trade school, tailoring, carpentry, hospitality management, mechanical engineering. 4 girls are now nurses. 2 more are in nursing school. 2 more are teachers. 3 are in college. It was after the first year that Neil Saunders provided the idea to create a friendship kit for each of the children, consisting of writing and drawing materials, crafts, games, and toys, as well as photos of you and your family. We now add children's vitamins and a recent hit on nail polish and balloons. Last year, I made the mistake of introducing the concept of water balloons to the children. 3 weeks of balloons exploded in just 2 days. At coffee hour, you can learn about friendship kits and how to create one. The children at the orphanage look forward to your kits and photos each year. Over the years, we've expanded the orphanage, provided opportunity for more Dalit children to live safely and prosper. We've added solar electricity, solar hot water, so the children have warm showers for the first time in their lives. We also have night tutors who come to the orphanage and supplement the daily 7 hours of schooling the children attend 6 days a week. And Marvin Drake has donated 20 recorders and music books, bringing joy to the children. In the devastated villages, we have built over 62 houses, as well as the first toilets, all composting toilets. We've also funded and built 3 preschools, giving children an education and a hot meal, as well as provide mothers the opportunity to work in the nearby rice paddies and earn $1.50 a day. This additional income is enough to ensure that the children will not have to leave school to work. With your support, we've also funded women's self-help groups to teach women's rights, sanitation, hygiene, and education, from micro-lending to women so they can develop and sustain small enterprises, raise the standard of living in their family and their villages. Enterprises include cows and goats for dairy production, classes on tailoring and foot treadle sewing machines, weaving thatched roofs, making bricks, weaving doormats. Another effort we fund is reclaiming land for Dalit villages, teaching drip irrigation and sustainable organic farming. We work closely with local non-governmental organizations, the Human Resources Defense Foundation, and BLESS, which supervise and help sustain these projects. So thank you for your generous contributions and support. 100% of the money you give goes directly to the children in these projects. There are photographs and more information available at coffee hour. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Each week we provide you in the service an opportunity for generosity. And that generosity is not just to the church, but also to the organization that selected that month to share in the plate, one half of the non-pledge offering. I invite you to be generous to both the church and to the Southeast India Project. The morning offering will be gratefully accepted.
Okay.
A reading from the book of Isaiah, chapter 2, verses 2 through 4. In the days to come, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will come to it. Many peoples will come and say, "Come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob, and we will be taught the ways of God so that we may walk in God's paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And God will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. And they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they study war anymore.
The Young Dead Soldier by Archibald MacLeish. They say we were young, we have died, remember us. They say we have done what we could, but until it's finished, it is not done. They say we have given our lives, but until it's finished, no one can know what our lives gave. They say our deaths are not ours, they are yours. They will mean what you make them. They say whether our lives and our deaths were for peace and a new hope or for nothing, we cannot say. It's you who must say this. We leave you our deaths, giving them their meaning. We were young, they say. We have died. Remember us.
Friends, we have had so much to share with each other this morning that we are running late. And this hymn that I had chosen is very in keeping with my style of worship. I like to preach about sad things. That's part of who I am. But I think that hymn is just a little too sad for right now. And I want to make sure to honor everyone's time in the best way that I'm able. Thank you. So that means it's time for me to preach. It is so good to be here with you all, friends. Since my fiancé and I recently moved to North Carolina, many different places feel like home. New England, where I spent 3 years in seminary and 1 year here serving you as your intern minister. Northern Virginia feels like home, where I grew up and where my family still lives, and which we can visit much more frequently now that we live so much closer. And finally, of course, North Carolina, where my fiancé Dustin has been working as the manager of a bike shop, and where I'm serving as a chaplain resident at the Durham Veterans Affairs Medical Center, one of the nation's fastest growing VA hospitals. So many places feel like home to me at this point in my life, but it is striking how much this place feels like home and how good it is to be together with you this morning. Thank you for welcoming me here today and for all of your love and support over the past months and years of my ministry. I love being here, and I love Unitarian Universalism, our beautiful liberal faith. As many of you may know, I grew up Unitarian Universalist, so my roots in this tradition run deep. I never had a faith home before the UU church that my family began attending during my preschool years. I feel so lucky to have grown up in a faith community that, like all others, had its faults. But undeniably, it did its best to teach me about tolerance, to make me feel worthy and included, and to provide a safe space for people of many different backgrounds. And while I do know some other lifelong Unitarian Universalists like myself, overall my story is not the norm. I don't have any formal statistics to draw from, but it has been my experience that a majority of those who attend UU churches had prior experience in churches of other denominations. And you'll see why this is important later in my sermon. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm currently working as a chaplain with veterans and their families in a region of our country that is home to large military and ex-military communities. In my position as a chaplain resident, I'm spending a full year in clinical pastoral education, which involves direct clinical care, study, writing, and reflection. I have four colleagues who are on this journey with me, and it has been so fascinating to get to know them and to hear their stories and how their paths brought them to where we all are together today. You can tell I don't preach very much in my new job. Well, one of my colleagues in my residency cohort shared with me about her calling to ministry, and she has repeatedly come back to the concept of church hurt. As a lifelong Christian who was raised in a conservative Pentecostal upbringing, my colleague has now landed in a liberal Baptist faith community, and she sees her calling as ministering to people who have been victims of church hurt, those who, for all kinds of reasons, have felt rejected or wounded by churches. I know that many Unitarian Universalists have experienced this phenomenon of church hurt. And for some, this was what led them to the UU Church. For some of you, I'm sure. And this, in fact, was the story of my own parents substituting in synagogue hurt for one of them. I never experienced church hurt. In fact, as a young person, I truly loved every part of my religious upbringing. It was, and it always has been, one of the greatest joys and supports of my life. Serving in UU congregations over the last few years, I have heard so many stories of church hurt that have been embarrassing, tragic, and hard to hear. And sadly, nowhere have I experienced this phenomenon of church hurt more profoundly than in working with our veterans. And during an era in which politics can feel so futile, and many of us wonder what we can actually do to effect positive change in our fractured nation, my message for us all this morning is that there is something we all can do to help heal just a little bit of the woundedness. We can continue our work to make our beloved faith communities a safe place for all kinds of people, including one group of people that we often do not think about in how we work to develop our Unitarian Universalist faith communities, veterans. Over the past few days in particular, and the past few years more generally, I have felt increasingly less able to discern ways to help heal our country's variety of broken systems around issues of racial justice, reproductive rights, immigration, and the prison industrial system, just to name a few. I have often heard fellow Unitarian Universalists expressing how much we want to help and how ill-equipped we feel to approach the massive scope of our nation's and our world's brokenness. Well, I feel lost and hopeless much of the time too, friends. The degree of suffering, hatred, and division in our world, our country, and even our own communities often feels insurmountable. But friends, I just want to share with you a little bit this morning, a little bit of the hope that I have gathered working these last few months with veterans, what I have learned that has given me hope. Well, there's a lot I learned working with veterans through hearing their stories at the Durham VA hospital. My own understanding of our nation's history has been fleshed out much more fully. I've met a Tuskegee Airman and sung hymns with him every week. I've heard the stories of veterans who served in the Ghost Army in World War II or in the Cambodian conflict during Vietnam. These veterans who weren't able to share their stories for decades due to the classified nature of these operations. I've learned about the resiliency of the human spirit. And I've also had veterans teach me all kinds of interesting things about life. I've heard from many veterans in the geriatrics clinic where I spend Tuesday and Thursday afternoons about their secrets to enjoying a good long marriage. In fact, this week, I heard advice from a veteran and his wife who have been married for 56 years and who were 16 when they got married. I've had multiple veterans talk to me about how to keep the cabbage worms from eating the collard greens that I grow in my garden. Unfortunately, multiple veterans have also recommended that I have 10 or 12 children to handpick the worms off, as they did alongside their many siblings when they were children growing up in rural North Carolina. And recently, I've learned about how to both boil and fry a squirrel, likely not a skill I'll need anytime soon as a 20-year vegetarian, but understandably, undeniably interesting to learn about. But most of all, I've learned from working with veterans that there is something we can do to heal just a little bit of the world's brokenness. In particular, a huge source of suffering and alienation for the millions of people in our country who are veterans. And while there is so much complexity involved in many of the conditions that affect veterans, like PTSD, traumatic brain injuries, and Agent Orange-related health conditions, there is at least one clearly identifiable, clearly addressable issue that affects many of our veterans and many other people as well. I'm talking about church hurt. It has been a sad process of reckoning for me to hear from so many veterans about how they do not feel safe, comfortable, or welcome in the churches of their cities and towns. Some of them are hard of hearing and unable to experience preaching and worship through the traditional avenues churches almost universally utilize. Some are differently abled and unable to get inside church buildings unless they use hidden back entrances near the dumpster. Some have PTSD and cannot tolerate large gatherings, but still yearn to go to church. Some are institutionalized in rehab and long-term care centers and have not ever been visited by a pastor, a chaplain, or a lay minister. It's interesting to me that the veterans' agenda is so often portrayed as being somehow separate from advocating for civilians, because in fact, so many of the needs of veterans are shared by people who have never served in the military. I think of the veterans who suffer from chronic pain and who would so benefit from an alternative medical treatment that's not covered by the VA or by their health insurance. Certainly a civilian issue as well. This has even occurred in my own life when I had to pay out of pocket to see a naturopath to diagnose me with food allergies. How much better I finally feel now that I know, and how privileged I was to be able to afford the help that I needed. I think today in particular of one of the veterans I've gotten to know through a spirituality group that I lead at the Durham VA's outpatient mental health clinic. This gentleman served as a Marine for 21 years, and experienced firsthand the horror of the Beirut barracks bombing, the deadliest single terrorist attack on American citizens overseas in our nation's history. This gentleman, who raised two children and who is currently raising two grandchildren, this gentleman who is giving and kind, who is, like each human being, a beloved child of God. This gentleman has shared with me that he believes he is so bad, so unforgivable, that he cannot even enter a church, although he deeply desires to be part of one. I have been meeting one-on-one with this man to discuss his need to feel forgiven and loved by God, and I have experienced a small, excruciating fraction of the massive church hurt he experiences every day. He drives by dozens of churches each time he comes to meet with me at the VA, and he has shared that he so wishes he could just go into one, but he can't. This is something we can work on. I know for a fact that the UUA's Welcoming Congregation Initiative, which embraces the inherent worth and dignity of all people, regardless of gender expression or sexual orientation, this has brought many people, including my own family, to UU churches. And just as we have grown in our understanding of how to build sexually healthy, diverse, and accepting congregations, so too do I think we can grow in our ability to be welcoming to veterans. A wise woman once made the statement, "Women's rights are human rights." And I agree. And today my message is that veterans' rights are also human rights. The needs of the veterans with whom I work are, on the whole, not different from those of the civilian population. Lately, veterans have shared with me that they want to learn how to be better parents and grandparents, better children, and better partners. I've heard veterans recently expressing that they wish for connection amidst this time of great isolation. They want to meet new friends or meet romantic partners. They want to regain custody of their children, that they hope to make new meaning after challenging diagnoses. I have seen some powerful needs lately among the veterans I counsel, and the rights that they are lacking in these situations are very much human rights. For example, I met with a veteran recently whose core need was one that we as Unitarian Universalists hold dear: access to comprehensive education about human sexuality. This veteran had, 30 years ago, been the victim of a sexual assault while serving in the military. Nobody had ever told him that a man could be the victim of rape, and so he suffered in silence, never telling a soul for 30 years of his life. Meanwhile, he raised 4 children, ran his own business, and somehow managed to live with chronic thoughts of suicide and untreated PTSD. In talking with this veteran, I came to learn that he had never told anyone about his assault, and he truly believed that he was the only man in the world who had been raped. To him, this was not only a profound trauma, but also an embarrassment that he linked somehow to his character. Obviously, he was so weak and unintelligent that he ended up being the one man in the history of the world to become a victim of rape. This is a human rights situation in which we can make a difference. If this man had had access to comprehensive sexuality education, something our faith offers to people of all ages through the Our Whole Lives program, he might not have felt so alone. He still would have had to live with the aftermath of his assault, but he would not have thought that he was the only man ever to experience this type of trauma. Access to information of this sort literally saves lives. Comprehensive sexuality education is a human right. Last month, a group of veterans from my hospital's long-term rehab center went to the North Carolina State Fair in Raleigh. Mostly Vietnam veterans, they shared with me that they were just thrilled. I think the word they used was tickled. Tickled to get to go to the fair, to ride on the VA's bus, to enjoy pig races, barbecue, fried okra, and people watching. And I was excited for them. I mean, who would enjoy something like this more than they would, I thought. They're a pretty patriotic bunch. And they deserve to be able to go to a fair celebrating the state in which they grew up, the soil that they farmed, the foods and drinks that they've enjoyed their whole lives. And I went to the fair myself a few weeks after the veterans did and found it to be a grand celebration of the beautiful state of North Carolina. And then while walking through the crowds of revelers, I heard gunshots sound. I grabbed my partner's hand, felt tears well up in my eyes. He held me. Eileen, he said, it's a turkey shoot. There are targets over there and you can pay to shoot at them. With a real gun, I asked. With a real gun, he told me. And my heart hurt for myself, a survivor of gun violence. But I got over it pretty quickly. But what I still have not gotten over is how triggering that must have been for my beloved veterans from the hospital, that unannounced gunfire out of nowhere. I thought of how shaken up I had felt and can only imagine that their experience was magnified 100-fold. I hate that for them. Going out in public and feeling relatively safe is a human right, and one that is routinely denied to women, people of color, GLBT people, immigrants, Muslims, and as it turns out, quite frequently, veterans. Safety is a human right. Companionship, connection, friendship, feeling worthy and loved, feeling like you belong, being able to tell your story and to be listened to, and to have people believe you. Understanding your rights and how your own body works. In my opinion, these are veterans' rights and human rights. So I urge you, if you are feeling hopeless in the face of all that is broken, consider directing some of your energy toward this cause that truly benefits people. What are some concrete ways to do that? Serve on the worship committee and help to keep Vespers services a tradition at this church. Veterans and others who struggle with large groups may feel more able to attend worship in a more intimate setting. I've had a veteran from this congregation say that to me. If the buildings you frequent in your community are not like this building, if they are not wheelchair accessible, and not just via a back entrance by the dumpsters, agitate for change. Think about new ways to make worship more accessible to people who are differently abled. Teach young people comprehensive sexuality education through the Our Whole Lives program. Volunteer to teach a parenting class or to lead an AA meeting in your community or even in a local prison. Read books and watch documentaries about PTSD, trauma, and healing. Visit with veterans through the DAV or other organizations that offer them fellowship. I think one of my favorite things to do through the DAV is to go and play bingo with the veterans. And, as some of you do each week, I urge you to continue to hold vigil outside this holy sanctuary and to pray for peace. Our world is full of hurting people, some of whom are hurting because of their experiences. They are hurting because of their experiences with church. Veterans, in particular, are hurting so much already. They have been hurt by the church and by the world. So my prayer for us today is that we can each think of a small way to make the hurt done by the church a little less, in honor of veterans' rights and of human rights. In closing, on Veterans Day each year, I reread Simon Wiesenthal's book, The Sunflower. As a Jew during the Holocaust, Simon Wiesenthal relates walking by a cemetery full of the graves of German soldiers and marveling at the beauty of the sunflowers that decorated each and every headstone. Wiesenthal realized that if he were to die in the Holocaust, nothing would mark his grave, and few, if any, would be left to remember his name. He would not get a sunflower. But it is my prayer today not only that all who have been harmed by war are remembered and honored, but it is my prayer today that in the future, we will need far fewer sunflowers to do it. Far fewer than we need today. May it be so.
Our words of benediction from Wayne Aronson. Take courage, friends.
The way is often hard. The path is never clear.
And the stakes are very high.
Take courage.
For deep down, there is another truth.
You are not alone.